Thank you, Your Honors, and good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Robert Perkla from Mountain Slow Law Firm. I do represent both Melissa Redinger and Scott LaFave in this action. I think a brief recitation of the facts would be in order. In late 2007, Stora Enso North America sold a paper mill that was located in Niagara, Wisconsin to NewPage Wisconsin Systems. Shortly thereafter, there was a coming together of strategizing amongst NewPage, and they decided at least by January 16th, 2008, which is less than a month from the time that the plant was purchased, that plant would be closed sometime in April of 2008, leaving roughly 3.5 months of operation going. The CEO of the company did inform the 300-some-odd employees of the Niagara Paper Mill of this fact. It did create some waves in the community, as this is one of probably the largest employer in the small community. And at that time, NewPage was offering a lot of helpful services, such as employment placement for employees that would be displaced as a result of the plant shutting down. And so for 2.5 months, as the mill was winding down, raw product was being used and converted into saleable paper and not being replaced, as one might imagine what would happen when a plant is being shut down. Salaried employees such as Scott LaFave and Melissa Redinger, who had forward-looking job positions at the mill that required an ongoing operation to complete their duties, started spending the majority of their time in the active search for some other employment in the rather limited local area of employment. Again, they were aided in this, encouraged by NewPage, and so around March 10th, the decision was made to activate the severance pay plan, and termination dates were issued for the salaried employees, including the plaintiffs. Those termination dates were in writing to be May 2nd, which is shortly after the mill had been planned to close and had been planned to close for several months now.
And then something like 14 days or 12 days after, depending on, some employees got the letters, the March 10th letter, right? Some got March 12th. But then March 24th, the company said it wasn't going to honor the severance agreement, and the plaintiffs hadn't accepted the severance offer before the company pulled it back. So why isn't this just a classic case of a party revoking an offer before it was accepted with no contract form?
Well, I guess that gets to the heart of what
right.
It is in ERISA, is whether or not we're operating under traditional contract principles. Is participating in an ERISA benefit plan akin to being offered the benefits available? And I would submit that it is actually not. What happens when an ERISA payment plan, and this is a liability that was taken over from Stora Enso North America, so it wasn't created by NewPage, but reaffirming and taking on that liability, you can assume that they were the ones that created it for the purposes of argument. And that once you create an ERISA payment plan, such as the one here, you have effectively created a new entity, okay, that is separate from the business and how it operates.
So you're saying that anyone who received the initial letter became a plan beneficiary for purposes of the severance?
Well, when you look at what the plan itself says, it has several requirements to become a beneficiary. Once the letters go out, the company has decided these people are being involuntarily terminated for the reasons spelled out in the plan. A reduction in force, business necessity, however you want to frame it, the closing of the plant was recognized by the company when they sent out these letters to be one of the triggering events that allows them to become participants and beneficiaries under the plan. Then, when you look at the plan, the only remaining requirements are that they execute the release of claims form, and that is all. So
help me with this. How do you distinguish those cases that talk about when the company is the plan administrator, the company is still allowed to make prudent business decisions?
And they are. The company itself is able to make business decisions. I mean, they're not handcuffed in referencing everything that they do to the ERISA plan and asking what kind of knock-on effect this might have. However, the plan administrator, the person designated by the company to administer this plan under the terms of ERISA, one of which is a great issue here, being in the sole benefit of the beneficiaries and participants of that plan, has to make his own determinations of how to administer that plan effectively and towards those laudable goals. Now, if the company makes a decision to close a plant after or to continue operating that plant, that is a decision that must then be taken into account when the person is administering it. And so when William Smith, the person who was administering this plan at this time, finds out on March 24th or whenever it was that he found out shortly before then, before this announcement, it was incumbent upon him to look at that and say, okay, now we have agreements out, we have termination dates given to employees, how do I administer this plan for the sole benefit of these people when now the company is saying they want to continue running? And I think the clearest answer to that is that you have made a determination and you're stuck with it, and so then you can make these new offers that are eventually made, such as, you know, more money to continue with the company until its final closure date that they've now determined is going to be a later time. But if the people do not want to join you in that journey, then in order to operate the plan under the fiduciary obligation that they have, you have to allow them to execute that agreement if it's within the allowances of the agreement itself and not based on the fact that the company wants these people to work now after they've changed their mind on a decision that affects the plan.
Where is it that you're stuck with it comes from?
What's that?
You said in the course of all that you're stuck with it. Where is the you're stuck with it come from?
Well, the company had committed to time frames in which the plaintiffs had to review these documents and decide whether or not to execute this release of claims form. Okay. And so 45 days were given for employees who had a certain age, and then 21 days was given for younger people. Scott Lefebvre had the 45 days. Melissa Redinger had the 21 days. And this was communicated in a written email that was sent out to all salaried employees that said barely and nakedly, if you're over 40, you have 45 days. If you're under 40, you have 21 days to execute this agreement.
And then didn't the plan revoke that, and why can't they revoke that?
Well, because I think at that time, when you created, and this comes into the promissory estoppel argument as well as all the others, is that you created expectations within your beneficiaries that they're going to have a certain period of time. There's facts in the record that show that both Scott Lefebvre and Melissa Redinger were ready to were going to execute these agreements, and the only reason that they failed to do so before March 24th was because of these time frames that were communicated to them. So once you've done this, well, then you have to abide by this communication. Otherwise, you're giving misinformation to a plan beneficiary, knowing that it's a false statement.
Beneficiaries as a whole received a benefit, didn't they? The beneficiaries as a whole got a retention bonus, and then when they were able to take advantage of the severance plan, it was still there. Same terms.
Are you speaking about the entirety of the employees at the mill now? Or
yes.
That were participating?
Which, of course, the ERISA plan has to be concerned about the members as a whole, the beneficiaries as a whole. I mean, you may take one or two people and say, well, it's inconvenient for them, but the beneficiaries as a whole did fairly well.
I don't necessarily disagree with that the beneficiaries as a whole may have benefited somewhat, but the fact that if you look and I've cited to some evidence in the record that I think certainly creates a question of fact on this issue of whether or not Melissa and Redinger and Scott LaFave were in any way essential to the operation of that mill. And if they were not essential to the operation of the mill, and yet they were being asked to give up jobs, again, in a very close community that has very few job opportunities, that they've been actively encouraged to do this, that at that point they're now being told, well, you have to stay here and do nothing, essentially, in order to get your severance. And while you're sitting here doing nothing, we're going to, you're going to lose these job opportunities.
But if we were to disagree with you and find the standard to be arbitrary and capricious, then wouldn't we be concerned more about the whole rather than isolated incidents?
Well, you would be concerned about the whole if these two people were representative of the whole. They can be separated out from the other persons of the mill and not change the analysis.
Yeah, but in terms of a good case, I mean, I don't think you really have a good case to rely on for that principle, because this arbitrary and capricious standard is something we have to look at. And when the administrator looks at the language of the plan, which says employees who voluntarily terminate their employment by resignation, et cetera, prior to being terminated by the employer and not involuntarily discharged, that's not a misreading of the plan or anything. And you don't really have a case that's helpful that says in this situation we should carve out an exception.
Well, taking the facts as they are in this case, you can look at, and it all depends on what standard we're using as well, whether we're using arbitrary and capricious or whether we're using the sole interest standard, and it depends on whether we're analyzing actions that occurred while William Smith was administering the plan or whether we're analyzing actions that occurred in making the determination to not give benefits at a later time. And those are two separate areas in which two separate standards of review apply. I've cited cases about the sole benefit analysis of the breach of fiduciary duty. And the breach of fiduciary duty is different from the claim that benefits were improperly denied under ERISA. There are two different sections of the ERISA law.
I understand.
And so
you don't have a fact situation that really is close to your situation in the cases you've cited.
Well, I don't think so. I think it's largely down to the uniqueness of our case. But if you look at
that's the point I was trying to get at. There's no case that supports this sort of carve out, which is what I was. That's just my language.
Okay. And if you look at the arbitrary and capricious, one simple example of how this decision was arbitrary and capricious is you had people like there was an employee, a salaried employee, Bob DeMay, who was also given the same letters, the same termination date of May 2nd, and he was granted his benefits under the ERISA plan.
He signed the agreement, though.
He signed the agreement on March 20th and turned it in. So now you have two people, or three people if you want to take both plaintiffs, and Bob DeMay. And the only difference between them is that Bob signed his 5 days earlier than my plaintiffs did. Yet the administrator is trying to say that his determination for whether or not benefits were going to be granted is that Scott Redinger and Scott LaFave and Melissa Redinger voluntarily terminated their employment. Well, whereas he's making a determination that Bob DeMay necessarily involuntarily terminated his employment. And yet they're equally situated, and the only difference is the signature of on the form. So he's not actually making a decision that one voluntarily terminated their position and one was involuntarily terminated from their position. What he's really making is a rubber stamp on a decision from the sphere over here that was separated, the company that still exists making business decisions, that said we don't want to accept these anymore because we want to continue running this mill. And then you have over here a person who's supposed to be making a decision based on other considerations, merely says, well, the company says that after the 24th, we're not accepting it. Therefore, I'm going to make a determination that these people were involuntarily dismissed or voluntarily terminated if they abide by the termination date that they were given. That's an arbitrary and capricious distinction between two equally situated employees. And I don't know where it is that the district court properly addressed this type of situation. I think that's certainly there's a question of fact about whether or not that was it. I do see my time is up. I would answer any more questions. Otherwise, I will sit down and go for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Piccola. Mr. Beto?
May it please the court. My name is Scott Bechtel. I'm with Michael Best and Friedrich in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I represent the defendant appellees, Sina, the severance pay plan, and NewPage. I think I would like to clarify the standard of review, the appropriate standard of review, because I think there's been some mixing of concepts here, and also provide some emphasis on how the plan administrator decision was both reasonable and well within the fiduciary duty standards. There's really two claims here, a claim under 502A1, benefits under an employee welfare benefit plan, and then also a claim under 502A3 where the plan administrator breached a fiduciary duty. There's an estoppel claim that kind of comes along here as well, also under 502A3. All the standard, though, should be the same, and that is we would view this, we believe, as the district court properly found, under the arbitrary and capricious standard. Why? Because the way the severance pay plan is written. The plan states that the plan administrator has the sole authority or discretion to interpret, to apply, to administer the plan, and to determine the eligibility for severance benefits. Therefore, this court is to afford deference to the administrator's decision. That's the Georgia Pacific case from this circuit, 1997, the James versus General Motors case, 2000, from this circuit. The burden is on the plaintiffs to show that the decision was wrong, but also the decision was, and I like this term, downright unreasonable. That's the Fuller case, also by this circuit, 1990. Now, the plaintiffs claim that the administrator, Bill Smith, had a conflict of interest. They raised this, as they've just said now, as a way to switch the court over to a de novo review standard, but all the cases that he has cited are not appropriate under the current Seventh Circuit law. If you go back to Chanaki versus Georgia Pacific, what the court has said there, this court has said, if the administrator does have a conflict of interest, all it means is that this court reviews the arbitrary capricious standard in a different light. As this court said, it does not change the standard of review, but it will cause the court to give the arbitrary and capricious standard more bite. So again, we stay at the arbitrary and capricious standard. Did this administrator, by the way, have a conflict of interest? No. First, the controlling authority under ERISA says that ERISA specifically endorses the idea that one can be a corporate officer and be a plan administrator. That's the Quaker Oats case that we cited. It's also cited in that Chanaki, Georgia Pacific case. Who is the administrator in this case? Bill Smith. And did he have a conflict of interest? Well, Mr. Smith is a longtime industrial relations officer, a longtime paper guy, if you will. He first worked for Stora Enso for many years. Then he transitioned over to NewPage when NewPage took over Stora Enso in 2007. I think it's actually wise that NewPage assigned a person like Mr. Smith with that corporate history to act as the administrator. He had knowledge of Stora Enso. He had knowledge of the plan. He knew the plaintiffs and the other employees in this case, and he also knew the operations. Did he have a conflict? No. There's no evidence in this record that the administrator had a conflict of interest. Also, if you look at some of the other cases that have been cited where there's indicia of conflicts of interest, none of those issues are present. We don't see that Mr. Smith has lots of stock or is a large majority owner, and we'd be worried about dilution of his shares or worth. These dollars, while very important to everyone in this case, are rather de minimis, about less than $100,000 compared to the value of the company. Its revenues are in the billions. The plaintiff's last attempt to ditch the arbitrary and capricious standard is they claim, well, somebody other than Mr. Smith as the administrator actually made the decision to deny benefits. But again, there's no evidence of that. The record evidence, in fact, shows that Mr. Smith was the administrator. He testified to that fact under oath. He wrote all of the denial letters that are in the record. He is your decision maker. The other cases that the plaintiff cited, the Sanford case, Samaritan case, Sharkey case, they don't apply because here the evidence shows the administrator made the decisions. So the standard is arbitrary and capricious, and we get into a fairly easy burden, actually, on the part of the plan and the plan administrator, as the James versus General Motors case said in this court, it's hard to overturn a decision of a plan administrator, and this one is hard as well. Was his decision reasonable? Yes. The plan states that if an employee voluntarily terminates, then that employee is not eligible, as the court has cited to the plan itself. That's at the Record 1, Exhibit A. These folks quit, and therefore they were not entitled to the severance. How the facts do bear that out. Both plaintiffs admit that they were told on March 10th and 12th that their last day of work would be May 2nd. Both admit that on March 24th, they were told that the facility would continue. It actually was a pretty happy announcement for most folks because it meant that they could continue to work from May until the end of October. And also, there was an inkling, and the announcement is in the record, that there might be a prospective buyer looking at the facility so the facility could continue on. And they were told also, and they admit this, that on March 24th, you needed to be at the plant until we shut the plant down, and we anticipate that would be at the end of October. If they kept working, as the court has noted, they would get some nice things. They would continue with their employment and their benefits. They would keep their severance pay and assistance with group health insurance continuation, as the justice has noted. And they also would get an additional kicker, a retention bonus for staying on through the end of October. The plaintiffs admit to all of that, that they were communicated in that fashion. They also admit, and this was telling, and we cited to it in the brief, that they really wanted to leave NewPage. They wanted to get out of there. They didn't want to keep working there. They wanted out, and therefore they quit. So the facts clearly show that they quit, and the benefits were properly denied by the administrator. The fiduciary duty claim, this is the 502A3 claim, is also easily rebutted by the plan in this case. Number one, the plaintiffs claim that the administrator breached a fiduciary duty to the participants by withholding information in March, and that affected their ability to get benefits from the plan. Now, the elements we cited from the Canapin case and then also in the James case are laid out in the brief. But as the James case said, a fiduciary duty arises only when there's a failure to provide material information about the plan and the fiduciary's silence is misleading. And we didn't have silence here. We actually had quite a bit of communication, quite a bit of chatter, and these plaintiffs knew exactly what was going to happen to them when they decided to quit and take these other jobs or take some time off rather than stay on with the rest of their coworkers and continue working. The plaintiff claims centers on communications in March about whether to keep the plant running, that the defendants, and they use a broad term there, had a fiduciary duty to advise as soon as the corporation made a decision to keep the plant running. Assumably, as the justice has indicated, there was a gotcha present here, and that is that the plaintiffs would have quickly signed their releases and the company would have been stuck with its earlier announcement. They seem to have wanted information so that they would not have been stuck themselves. As the district court properly held, though, these March decisions are all about the business. Are we going to run it? How do we run it? When do we communicate to the employees? What types of retention benefits might we provide in addition? Those are business decisions, distinct from decisions about eligibility for benefits by an administrator. Moreover, the evidence shows that the defendants were not withholding plan information when the plaintiffs asked about after the announcement of March 24th what might happen. The evidence shows that the HR and plant management told them, well, if you quit now and you don't stay till the end of October, I think you're not going to get your severance pay plans. They were told that. These are opinions which ended up being correct. That is not the stuff of a fiduciary duty claim. It is not a failure to provide material information. The Chinaki versus George Pacific case, I keep citing to it, it's a pretty instructive case for our case, says specifically it's not a breach of fiduciary duty if an administrator opines as to benefit eligibility and that opinion becomes reality, and that is what happened here. The plaintiffs also claim that the administrator's fiduciary duty is exclusive to the participants, even to the exclusion of interpreting the plan reasonably. As the district court noted, a severance pay plan is not a gold watch. Its purpose is to create economic incentive for employees to stay and work until facility closure. In this case, it's very important because it would maximize the value of that facility for potential sale. That would benefit not only the company, but all the workers and everyone else connected to that plant, and it would also maximize profitability until closure. And I do believe, with all respect, that counsel has just read 502A3 much too narrowly, and when the fiduciary is doing his business, his or her business, they need to look at the interest of the participant, singular, and participants, plural, and must also, there's a section in 502A3 that talks about interpret the plan itself, and this administrator interpret the plan. There's also an estoppel claim under 502A3. The first claim here is that this 45-day consideration period in the severance agreement and release would have stopped the plan from revoking the offer. I think the court has asked the appropriate questions there, and it's really not the law. This is a darned if you do, darned if you don't type of position for employers, because in order to get a valid and effective or a knowing and voluntary release under an age claim act, which was part of the severance pay plan, the employer needed to provide this advance notice to the workers so that they could see whether or not age discrimination was occurring. As the Ellison case that we cited instructs, that 45-day consideration period does not make this an unrevocable offer, and I think that case is most instructive for this circuit's purposes. Lastly, on preemption, the plaintiffs bring two state law claims. They kind of bring in another estoppel claim. Really, it's a promissory estoppel claim under our Wisconsin law, the Peterman case and Reddall case, classic state law claims. They also bring a breach of contract claim. These are clearly preempted under Section 514 of ERISA. ERISA supersedes any and all state laws that relate to any benefit, employee benefit plan. And as our Supreme Court has instructed in the Engelhoff case, 2001, the preemption doctrine is expansive. So clearly those state law claims are preempted. We would ask the court to affirm the district court in all respects. And if there are no questions, I thank you.
Percola, I think your time would expire, but you may have 2 minutes.
I would just briefly address the state law claims that I hadn't had a chance to get to before. I did cite in my brief the Bullwinkle case, which does say that the federal common law does parallel state rules when it comes to a contract claim. I think a breach of contract claim in this instance is cognizable under federal common law. And if you look at the actual agreement itself that was involved in this case, if we're going to treat that as a contract, it does have a choice of law provision which says that it will be interpreted according to the laws of the state of Wisconsin. And put forward in my brief the reasons why a contract claim under the rules and regulation of the state of Wisconsin, if federal common law indeed does parallel that, would create at least a question of fact whether or not a contract was formed and breached in this situation. I think that there's certainly enough information to conclude that an option contract was put out there, that consideration for that option remaining open was given by the plaintiffs, that then required that any modifications or any change in that period of time, it could not be revoked within that period of time.
You think we'd have to change circuit law to recognize that?
I think the circuit would have to make a firm statement about how it treats state law claims in these types of situations where you have kind of a hybrid ERISA plan that then grafts onto itself a contract in order to get to the plan. And that's a difficulty that I don't see addressed in the case law, so I would certainly ask that the court address that issue. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.